Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being here to share the Dharma today. As usual, please feel free to shift your posture as needed, but however you sit, keep the back straight and the head up. Today I'm going to return to the original teachings of the Buddha, namely the Eightfold Noble Path. It's good to go back to basics every now and then, and while Zen emerged from the confluence of classical Indian Buddhism and Chinese Taoism, it's still a sect of Buddhism. The Eightfold Noble Path is the fourth noble truth. The four noble truths are: one, suffering is universal. Two, the cause of suffering is the thirsting desire of the ego self. Three, the release from suffering is seeing clearly the ego self and letting it go. And four, the Eightfold Path itself, the path to the release from suffering. The path, the way, the manner of being, the Tao, both the goal and the method. To walk the path is to practice the way and is to be the way. Dogen said that practice and enlightenment are one and the same. The Tao is the path in the mountains of enlightenment. And when we walk it, we are in the mountains. Some have been there a long time and know the territory. Others are just entering the foothills. But all are the Tao. All are enlightened. The eight parts of the Eightfold Path are traditionally divided into the three teachings: Prajna, transcendent wisdom; Shila, morality or virtue; and Samadhi, deep absorption. Prajna consists of right view and right thought, or right intention. Shila consists of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Samadhi consists of right effort, right recollection, and and right concentration. Now the right, in right view, right thought, and so forth, doesn't have anything to do with correct or incorrect. It's not right versus wrong. Better terms might be effective, intelligent, or skillful. The Buddha never wasted his time talking about cosmic morality or the will of God. He taught a path that works. In fact, he didn't care who said what, as long as it was true, effective, and skillful, pointing to the Dharma. Some months ago, I gave a talk on the first piece, or the first lane, of the Eightfold Path, right view, or right understanding. Even to begin practice in any spiritual path requires some small degree of right view. In the end, enlightenment, realization, is complete right view. So right view, or right understanding, is the alpha and omega of our practice and of our aspiration. Today I want to take up the second piece of the Eightfold Path, right thought, or right intention. Again, for right intention, a degree of right view is necessary. Without right view, right intention is meaningless, to say nothing of the other six facets of the path. It's like telling a blind man to head west without bothering to point him in the right direction. Right view provides the map, the direction. Without that, we are lost. And whatever our intentions might be, we go floundering off in all directions. When we speak a right thought or intention, i.e., that which is skillful and effective, it is more than just an intellectual understanding and more than just a resolution that arises from the discursive mind. How often do we make New Year's resolutions or other kinds of vows for self-improvement? And for how long are we able to keep them up? Now, in one sense, right intention is the intention to pursue the way, and it may indeed come out of a lot of thought and soul-searching. That's all good. But at some point, that intending mind must be abandoned, for there is still the I intending to reach something. There is the danger here that intention can become a way of self-reform. I'm going to be good, virtuous, peaceful, enlightened. As long as we attach to an I, we're in trouble. The conscious discursive mind is really the smallest part of what we think of as the self. There is no way, no matter how determined that little bit might be, that our total lives can be transformed from decisions made by that limited mind alone. Conscious intention, the way we normally think of it, is delusion. Far from initiating action, this conscious intention is a construct that follows action. After all, if the ego self is an illusion, how can this piece of fiction intend or control anything? Whatever this body does, the self is very quick to jump in and say, I planned it that way. And we believe it. We want to believe it. Sung San often said, don't check your mind. If you spend a bunch of time cogitating, should I or shouldn't I, how much this or how much that, that's not practice. And it is not where right intention can arise. Only if there is a commitment that comes from the very depths of our being can it be maintained for any length of time. The words and actions of the great masters arise spontaneously, without thought or intention. Where do these come from? Can the emotional, spiritual, gut-level aspect of ourselves be brought in that bypasses the conscious, scheming mind? In case number 18 in the Wumen Guan, a monk asked Master Dongshan, what is Buddha? Dongshan said, 3 pounds of flax. Case 21 in the Wumen Guan. A monk asked Yun Men, what is Buddha? Yun Men said, a shit stick. Case 32 in the Blue Cliff Record reads in part, Elder Ding asked Lin Ji, what is the essential point of Buddhism? Lin Ji, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Were any of these responses intended? Did they arise out of thought? How could they? Does lightning think about it before it strikes? With long, sincere, and honest practice, right intention, as we normally think of it, becomes something else. It moves beyond conscious intention. For this, I would use the term right instinct, or even right habit force. Unlike thoughts which arise willy-nilly, or conscious intention which is pretty fragile, right instinct, or habit force, is something that can be cultivated with practice. It is this right instinct that leads directly to right speech, right action, right livelihood, bypassing the conscious mind. It is only through practice that any genuine change occurs. The right instinct that emerges from practice is not just mental, but also physical. There are three practices that can lead to this right instinct. Well, there are more, but these are the main ones. The first of these practices is dana. Dana is often translated as generous giving or almsgiving or charity. In the deepest sense, however, dana is relinquishment. Relinquishment of what? Here is what Bai Zhang said in answer to a question about dana. He said it means total relinquishment of ideas as to the dual nature of good and bad, being and non-being, love and aversion, void and non-void, concentration and distraction, pure and impure. By giving them all up, we attain to a state in which all opposites are seen as void. The real practice of the Dhanaparamita entails achieving this state without any thoughts of now I have relinquished all of them. So in our formal practice on the mat, we let go of everything, good, bad, self, other, and all the rest of it. But the fact that dana is far more than charitable giving does not mean to exclude alms or charity. In fact, charity in our world of time and space is a huge part of the practice of dana. It is a path to right instinct. This dana includes generous giving of material goods, time and work, and spiritual aid. Now we have to be careful here. That old saw about giving till it hurts is not it. If there's a feeling of sacrifice, a sense of loss, that's not it. Dana, giving, is practiced in the same manner a tree gives its leaves in the fall. If we understand at some level that there is no separate self, we can practice that kind of natural, instinctive selflessness. In terms of dana as charity, one has to stay within one's capacity. We're all human and have human limitations. If there is that feeling of wrenching sacrifice with the act, then chances are you won't do it again. It's like the person that comes to a seminar here, gets all inspired, and so the next morning levers himself into a full lotus and sits there in screaming agony for 40 minutes. Chances are he'll never do it again. One of our former members, who's now retired to Mexico, gave a talk once in which he mentioned that he tried the practice of always putting a bill, currency, into the donation box every time he came to the center. Well, if he had a 1 or a 5, that was pretty easy. But if all he had was a 20, it became more of a challenge. So yes, one could put a $100 bill into the donation box. But for most of us, we probably wouldn't want to do that again tomorrow, or maybe for quite some time. That's not building the habit force. Just as sitting 10 minutes a day on a regular basis is better than sitting an hour once a week, placing a 1 or a 5 in the box regularly is better, that is to say, more effective practice than putting a 50 or a 100 in every month or two. The same applies to other acts of dana, whether it is putting something in the Salvation Army kettle at Christmas, giving one's time for SAMU or other volunteer work, or dropping stuff off at a thrift store as one is able to. Or just bringing a small gift when visiting friends. The point is not to indulge in fantasies of perfection or in relinquishment as a form of self-punishment or some sort of atonement. Dana relinquishment is not an ego-boosting sacrifice. It is an unburdening, and it must be seen and practiced as such. That's why I like to shop at thrift stores. It's an acceptance and honoring of someone's cast-offs, which is dana. The second practice is goodwill, the desire for all beings to be happy and free from suffering. Now this begins as a mental thing, but there's a very effective exercise that we practice at every Canon ceremony. That's the metta prayer. It's the one that starts out, may I be happy. May I be free from strife and disease. May I be free from suffering. May I attain peace. Then the verse is repeated, but instead of I, it is, may my family and friends be happy. And then again, starting with, may those I conflict with be happy. And finally, may all beings be happy. We have to start with ourselves. After all, each of us is one of the many beings. And if I am angry and miserable, how am I going to feel any sort of goodwill towards others? Excuse me. The metta prayer is a practice that one can do while sitting on the mat, when one wakes up in the morning, sitting on the edge of the bed, or maybe while you're lying in bed at night before you go to sleep. Establishing this mental habit will eventually reflect in the activities of our lives. The third practice is non-harming, the avoidance of doing willful harm. This is a practice of awareness, a deep and wide awareness of what we do and of the consequences of our words and actions. In some ways, I find this the most difficult and subtle practice. It's very hard to know how our words and actions, coming on the spur of the moment, will affect others. I think the most important aspect of non-harming is listening to others, seeing others clearly, not trying to figure anything out, just looking and listening with an open mind and an open heart. At his Ascending the Mountain ceremony in Rochester, that's the transmission ceremony, someone asked Bodhin Kolhed, Philip Kaplow's Dharma successor, what he was going to do as the new abbot of the Rochester Zen Center. He replied, looking, just looking. And what happens when you look and see clearly? The Buddha said, see yourself in others. Then whom can you hurt? What harm can you do? So in these ways we practice and realize right intention that becomes right instinct, and right action, right speech, and livelihood arise naturally therefrom. But remember, practice happens in the here and now. It is when we try to go beyond the immediate experience, in and of the present moment, things get difficult and traps abound. If we go into any activity with the notion that I'm going to save the world, we are aiming for disaster. Right instinct does not happen outside the here and now. There's that old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Intentions that arise out of ideas of perfection or some utopian fantasy invariably lead to disaster. When a high government official, Lu Gang, took his leave from Nanchuan to take up his duties as magistrate, Nanchuan asked him, "Your Excellency, how will you govern the people?" Lu Gang said, "I will govern with wisdom and compassion." Nanchuan said, "In that case, every one of them will suffer." The most harmful thing one can do is pursue a utopian vision of a non-existent, abstract future. Actions we take may seem one way and turn out to be quite something else. At first look, it might seem that wind power is a great idea. But a Stanford University study showed that some 250,000 migratory birds, eagles, and hawks are killed every year by these giant windmills. Electric vehicles might seem like a great idea, but the lithium and other toxic rare earth elements that are needed for the batteries, even in your cell phones, tablets, and cameras, are being produced and refined mainly in countries like China at the cost of horrific environmental damage. The refusal of banks to help finance hydroelectric dams in Africa for fear of doing environmental damage condemns millions of human beings to life without the electricity, which we take so casually for granted. Organic food seems like a good idea, but if all food were grown organically, most of the earth would starve. I don't want us all to go into paralysis. There are no easy answers. Not everyone has the time and inclination to make a study of the actual worldwide effects of what we might think is good for the environment, the economy, humanity in general. But we have to avoid false notions that virtue can be purchased sight unseen with no remote consequences. We practice in our own lives dana, goodwill, and non-harming, not with the idea of saving the world. The world is an abstraction. You can't save an abstraction. Our practice is to let go of the abstract world and the abstract self and live in the ultimate reality of the spaceless here and the timeless now. This may seem like a very self-centered sort of practice, but if we truly have faith in the oneness of ourselves and all beings, it's not a problem. Whatever comes out of my hopefully right instinct is my actions, my speech, my thoughts. The moment I try to impose those actions, thoughts, and speech on others, I am no longer a Buddhist. I am a tyrant. In saving ourselves and helping those immediately around us, the simplest actions, like a pebble dropped into still water, will spread ultimately throughout the universe. A few days ago, someone, I think it was Joel, emailed a link to a beautiful video of a young man going through his life as a bodhisattva. He moves a potted plant under a leaky roof gutter, helps an old woman with her pushcart, feeds a stray dog, gives money to a beggar's child. Everything he did was in the moment, the instinctive spur-of-the-moment practice of the bodhisattva. He was not trying to save the world. He was saving the universe, one moment at a time, one being at a time. And together with all beings, we realize the way.